honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, showcasing stories from a few of the nearly 1 million African-American veterans of World War II in honor of Black History Month. Walter Smith was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, when Imperial Japan bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
At that time, I was a teenager, of course, and a football game was on the radio. And I think it was interrupted. The news came over and so forth. And, of course, I was excited like everybody else. I hadn't been following the news that closely, and I didn't know that we were ready to go to war. I got with some of my other teenage friends, and we said, well, hey, we want to go. I guess that was our youth talking and so forth, but we wanted to go on our own terms. In the meantime, we heard that the Canadians weren't as segregated as our forces were, and that there was a good chance that we could get into the air branch in the Canadian Air Force. We made a dash up there, but things didn't turn out like we thought, so that was the end of that. I guess we just didn't fit the qualifications. So, we came back and waited for the draft. That didn't take very long. We were in segregated outfits, of course, on segregated bases, too. And I remember most of the bases, we had a certain area that we were restricted to. Headquarters was in what we called white area. And if you wanted to go into headquarters, you had to get permission and so forth. It was just an odd thing. It was hard to get used to. And besides, don't forget, in those days, everything, the water fountains and the things like that had signs. You only could use the ones designated for color. When I first went in, I got by training up in Massachusetts. There still was a stigma because, you know, soldiers always like to go to bars and have a drink and relax and all that sort of thing. But then we found out that some of these bars and so forth didn't want to cater to you. That's where I got in a typical fight. I guess that's where I got my first wound. I got stabbed in a fight when the three or four of us went into a bar. They didn't want to treat us right or serve us appropriately.
Is this a situation where you're in uniform or out of uniform?
Oh, in uniform.
In uniform.
In uniform.
And there's a war going on.
Yeah.
And they know who you're working for.
Oh, yeah. We were all teenagers. I think those guys they hadn't been drafted yet or anything like that, so they were a little older. But they didn't appreciate us coming to their bar. So that was the name of the game. I mean, pretty much everywhere. It wasn't that bad. I mean, so I got stabbed. I bled a little and all that sort of thing. I mean, it was nothing that would put me out of commission or anything.
I can't imagine having that much self-control to put up with some of this stuff and not just go crazy. How did you deal with that ever-present reality without just going ballistic on people?
Well, I think there's always a degree of hope that's involved with the African-Americans in this country. It goes back to the church, too, I think. Lots of us were raised in the church. We believed that things would get better. Really, they did gradually, but it was a slow process. We thought we were going to be fighters. I mean, that was the thing. I guess that's a macho attitude. And you find out that you're using the shovel and the axe and the pick and, you know, all that sort of thing and doing really, you know, just ground digging work.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And a lot of KP.
Yeah.
Now, your officers, so your unit is exclusively black, except for the officers,
oh, yeah,
who were predominantly white.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you told me that you can't prove it, but many of you were convinced one of your officers had been in the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. And it wasn't a fact that he tried to hide or anything like that, but I know when we moved to an area where we were doing some work, and there was a lake nearby, and of course the area was predominantly white. I mean, we figured on our off time we'd go to the lake and swim, and he forbid us to do that. I mean, the population had nothing to do with that. This was an order from him.
And, just being spiteful.
Yeah. So things like that, you know. Of course, we couldn't go to the lake and swim in the lake that belonged to white people and so forth.
I imagine that there was a lot of commiserating, or at least you guys would share your stories and your experiences. How much did it help to be in that with other people who were going through the same thing? How much did you draw on each other for strength in a situation that had to be frustrating?
Well, I think a lot of it. We understood what was going on, and I remember, I mean, some guys were very dissatisfied, and one guy decided to desert, and we all knew about it. So when something like that happened, you know, he didn't come back from leave, and so they would investigate, talk to the people in the outfit, and wanted to know where he had gone and what was his thoughts and all that sort of thing. And you just played neutral, that's all.
Didn't want to rat him out.
That's right.
Yeah.
But that was his way of dealing with the situation.
What kept you going? What kept you motivated to serve your country when some of your fellow citizens aren't treating you the way that you wanted to be treated?
Because there was always, we always knew that there were people who wanted to help us and do better. I mean, even during slavery time, I mean, the Quakers and so forth and units like that backed us up and helped with the Underground Railroad, as they called it, and so forth. And so we knew that there was always hope. Mm-hmm. Things would get better. Things were gradually getting better in certain places. So that's the thing that kept us going.
And you decided at some point that you would feel a lot more fulfilled and have a lot more excitement if you got out of that unit that you were in. How did you accomplish that?
Well, at the time, it depended on the president's wife. And Mrs. Roosevelt was pushing to have black troops in combat outfits. And, of course, she succeeded, and that started with the some of the outfits, like the, I think it was the 99th, and a couple of black regiments, and, of course, the Japanese regiment.
Before 42nd, so forth, yeah.
And, but there were just a few, but at least that was showing that there was hope. And everything.
Integration was starting.
And it was a fight because lots of people objected to it. The word came down that they were going to let blacks be in the paratroopers and so forth. And so it wasn't something that they would just announce and say, here, we want you to volunteer. It seemed to be sort of a word that was passed down through the network or something. And once you heard about it, I mean, I went into headquarters and wanted to put in my application and so forth. And, of course, it worked out.
So you ended up with the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion.
Yeah.
Otherwise known as the Triple Nickels.
Right.
And you went through the same training. At Fort Benning,
went through the same training
that all the white paratroopers made.
Right.
You hear a lot of times about the 82nd Airborne or the 101st Airborne, right, and what they did on D-Day.
Right.
And this is what you thought you would be doing.
Yeah, because we were a part of those units, but we weren't because we were attached, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when they decided that they were going to go across, they didn't want to take us.
So they were heading to Europe to get ready,
right,
for Operation Overlord and this massive invasion in June of 1944. And what happened to you guys? And how frustrating was it that you weren't going with
them? That's right. It was very frustrating. And then we found out that we would be assigned to the West Coast Command here as in the West Coast Defense Force, and that meant that they used us for smoke jumping, firefighting, and so forth.
It must have been an emotional roller coaster for you, because here you're frustrated in the unit you're in. You think you're getting into something a little more exciting and fulfilling with the paratroopers, and then right as everyone's about to ship out, you get sent to the other side of the country, nowhere near where all the fighting's going on.
That's right.
How did you deal with that?
Well, I guess not too well. I mean, most of us were a little bit discouraged about that, but that was the name of the game, so we played along with it.
One of the things I read was that the Japanese actually had hydrogen-filled balloons that were unmanned, but equipped with the right mechanisms to know when to release a sandbag to go up higher that could make it all the way to the West Coast and then drop these incendiary bombs in U.S. forests. I had never heard of that before I read up on the smoke jumpers. Now, you don't know how many of the fires you fought were caused by those bombs or not, but tell us a little bit about what these smoke jumps were like, and did you feel like you were in danger as you're dropping out of this airplane to a smoke-filled forest?
Oh, no. I mean, we knew we were near the fires and so forth. I mean, it was just like one of the fires we went to was up in Montana, I think it was. After we jumped there, they took us to the camping area where the firefighters were supposed to congregate and then go to the fire. And it was amazing because the town seemed so small that you could look and see from one end of the town to the other. And on top of that, you could look from the town and just see lots of open space and then the forest and everything. It was just completely different from, I mean, having basically lived on the East Coast and raised on the East Coast and everything, that you had so much space and everything and so many trees and so many fires and all that sort of thing.
And they had to drop you in by parachute just because of how remote these locations were?
Yeah, mostly because it was remote. The fire and the smoke, that was our worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't think about snakes and things like that. Although, I mean, running animals and so forth, I mean, they did pose a problem, but that was the major problem.
Probably coming from a big city on the East Coast, it was kind of nice to see all of that nature, as you talked about.
Right.
How long did this go on for? Were you doing this until the end of the war? Or?
Yeah, to the end of the war. Then most of us decided to get out. Everybody was leaving the service at that time because, after all, the war was over. And you had a choice. I left the service, the active duty service, and was on the...
You were in the reserves?
In the reserves.
But the GI Bill gave you the money to go to college?
GI Bill, I decided to go to college on that. And there were some of us who did that. That's where I ended up at Hampton University. And, of course, everything worked out from then on.
Well, and that's where you met your wife. So I think someone had that plan for you to end up at Hampton.
I hope so.
And you're convinced that none of this would have happened. And I want to get to this because you made the statement to me that segregation saved your life. The segregated military saved your life. I guess you're convinced that you wouldn't have been there at Hampton to meet your wife or anything since then if the government hadn't sent the white paratroopers over to Europe and sent the black paratroopers to the West Coast. When did you make that realization? And explain that for our listeners, if you can, why you say that segregation saved your life.
Well, we had to have some kind of a joke to cover up the insult and so forth. And, of course, you always do that sort of thing. You put something funny in. That's the way you survive, you know. We said, well, the white paratroopers went over and caught hell on the first... on the initial assault and everything. We weren't there, so we didn't catch hell. So we said that was the point, that probably that segregation saved our lives.
Well, and it, like you say, it is a good laugh line, but there's some pretty solid truth to it, too, because, as you mentioned, the casualties, the significant casualties that those paratroopers suffered over there, that easily could have been you if you were there.
That's right.
And you stayed in the reserves, so you know... There's a chance of another war. There's a chance Uncle Sam can call you back. And you had a little, I won't say you had a conversation with yourself, but you told yourself something. You made a determination of what you would and wouldn't do. Tell me what that was.
I said I would never fight in a segregated outfit, and that was it.
It just hurt you as a person so much.
Right.
And so here along, just 5 years after World War II, here comes the Korean conflict. You're recalled. What's the Army doing with you?
Well, the transition was taking place, but transition in any force is slow. And our unit had not reached that stage yet. So we had orders to go overseas.
With an artillery unit.
With an artillery unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still going to be segregated. And so I decided, no, I'd promised myself I'd never do that. So I put in for my resignation. And the only way I could do this, having being in the military service, was that I could not go resign with my rank. I have to go into another service. It took a lot of thought. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of soul searching and so forth, because some of the other officers in our black unit, I mean, thought that was ridiculous to give up a lieutenancy.
You were at the time a second lieutenant.
Yeah.
And they told you, if you want to do this, you can go to the Air Force, but you're not a second lieutenant anymore. What? How much rank would you have to give up?
All of it.
All of it.
So I'd go in as an airman.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did.
That's probably a pretty big cut in pay, too, isn't it?
Oh,
to go
yeah.
from a second lieutenant to an airman?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
But it meant that much to you.
Right.
To not serve in a segregated unit.
Right.
Walter Smith would go on to serve as a navigator on B-29 bombing missions during the Korean War. He remained in the Air Force until 1969, flying with refueling planes during the Vietnam War. He never regretted that decision to give up his rank over the principle that all men are created equal. We've heard just a portion of Mr. Smith's inspiring story today, and of course you can link to that complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.